We are our grandmother's prayers, our grandfather's dreamings were the breath of our ancestors, but sometimes we forget that, don't we? Why might we forget our ancestors? My Unitarian Universalist colleague and coach is Reverend Jake Morrill. Some of you may have seen him online. He's got a good online presence. He told me once the story about how after World War I, the United States was furious at Germany, right? And rightly so. And his great-grandfather was a little boy at that time here in the United States, a member of a family who'd immigrated from Germany. One day after school, this little boy was beaten up by other kids because of his German identity. And that day, everything changed for their family. That day, they completely cut off from their German roots. They stripped all German culture from their home, their practices, their diet, their art, and even the Methodist Church, which has German ancestry, changed in that neighborhood and across this country to distance itself from Germany. Now, German immigrants weren't the only ones who were cutting off the roots of their family trees. It actually was a mandate from our government that all people of European descent do so. The president at the time was Woodrow Wilson, and he put an end to what he called hyphenated Americans. Here's what he said, and I quote, "The one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin, of preventing all possibility of its continuing to be a nation at all, would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities, an intricate knot of German Americans and Irish Americans, English Americans, French Americans, Scandinavian Americans, Italian Americans, each preserving its separate nationality, each at heart feeling more sympathy with the Europeans of that nationality than with other citizens of the American Republic. So there shall be no hyphenated American who is a good American. Any man who carries a hyphen about him carries a dagger that he is ready to plunge into the vitals of this republic whenever he gets ready." Wow. That is a mandate, isn't it? And I believe that that mandate led white European Americans to forget their ancestors. It helped build a land, a culture that denies the pain experienced by those ancestors and the pain caused by them. That mandate built a country that denies the gifts and the love of the ancestors, a culture that forgot all of those spiritual practices from long ago. Like our earlier reading said, we forget the ways that people gathered together to make sense of their life and the place and their place in the cosmos. We live in an American culture that asks people to leave their belongings and their suitcases and their memories behind. And as we all know, all too well today, we live in a country that even asks some people to leave their children behind at the border when they cross. This isn't new, and it was happening long before World War I of the early 1900s. The genocide of Native Americans is a classic and most powerfully and deeply hurtful example of cutoff, of disconnection from roots, all in the name of colonialism. The realities of slavery, of course, are cut off from people from their families. Our country's been separating people from their families since America was America. President Wilson just named it, required it, and perpetuated it. Assimilate or have no power. Strip away your culture, leave it at the door, and maybe then you'll have some power. Juana Bordas wrote a book called Salsa, Soul, and Spirit. And the book is rich with practical advice for leaders who want to dismantle white supremacy culture. And when I use that term, I am, in UU circles especially, I'm not implying that any of us are white supremacists. But we have been raised in a culture that makes whiteness supreme, in American whiteness supreme. So Juana Bordas articulates 8 principles for multicultural leadership that helps us just get a clue about what we've been steeped in. And whether you're a leader in the business world or in nonprofits or in your family, wherever you are at church, she gives us these 8 principles that we can use. And the very first one is to learn from the past. And she uses Sankofa to help us get at what she means. On the side, you see a picture of Sankofa. It's the mythological West African bird whose name means go back and fetch it. You'll notice that its feet are firmly planted, representing the present moment. Its head is turned backward toward the past, and the egg in its mouth represents the future, the birth, the possibilities for the future. The Akan people from Ghana believe that learning from the past ensures a strong future. And as life marches forward, the knowledge of the past must never be forgotten, they believe. And Sankofa invites us to bring forward the meaningful and useful values and the spiritual traditions from past generations. It encourages us to go back and learn from the experiences of our ancestors so that we can avoid the dead ends and the pitfalls of history. It encourages us to stop disconnecting from our roots. So over the past several years, I've been going back to fetch it. And your theme this month is, it's personal. And much of my work has been personal. I've been exploring the burdens passed down from my ancestors. I've been acknowledging them, releasing them, and promising never to pass them on. I've been embracing the blessings of those past generations. It's personal. And it's collective. Acknowledging patterns in my own lineage that oppressed others is helping me see what not to repeat, and the ways my people were oppressed is really informing the ways in which I move in the world. So I've got 2 stories to share. You ready? Okay. I'm Irish American, Kelly, and I just spent 2 weeks in Ireland. Now, after some really good left-brain ancestry.com work, I figured out that my known ancestors, the ones that can be named, lived mostly in Northern Ireland, which just brings all kinds of issues. I got the sense, and I was confirmed over there, working in churches with librarians, that they indeed were Protestant, not Catholic. Going back even further, though, I got clear that my people were indigenous Celts, what we might call Druids today. So on my pilgrimage to Ireland, I started by visiting the sacred sites of the indigenous. Newgrange, where that structure where the light shines in perfectly in a straight line on the winter solstice, that was built 500 years before the pyramids in Egypt. The Hill of Tara, where St. Patrick first went to meet the Celtic kings and religious leaders and overthrow their power, that's where the ravens cawed and flew over me, dropping feathers at my feet when I visited there. I visited Caramore, a cemetery dating back 6,000 years, and Queen Maeve's grave, the queen who eventually became a goddess dedicated to helping people come into their power and their sovereignty. It was at her grave that I almost got blown over, literally. The wind was so strong. As our reading said, for 5,000 years or more, for 15 generations or more, human beings have been invoking spiritual power, and my people were doing that. They were calling on the spirits of the air, the earth, the fire, and the water. They called the bear and the deer, and they asked for the raven to protect them. So when the feathers dropped, I felt this cloth of protection. They pleaded for the heroes of old to slay the monsters. Then they imputed power to those spirits and to the memories of the actual heroes, Queen Maeve. They called them gods and goddesses, and they were invoked. everywhere, every group of people gathered to make sense of their lives. And I went to the place where they gathered, and I grieved for the ways in which those beliefs were colonized. And I had a chat with St. Patrick, let me tell you, and resolved some of my anger, but also asked him and his spirit to help break the patterns of oppression. I went back and fetched that indigenous part of my lineage and that part of me that calls to reciprocate with the natural world, to soak up its healing and to heal it. Then I walked the land where my known relatives in my dad's line lived. And there are a lot of stories, but I'll share just one. See, for generations, the men in my family have been plagued with addiction. My great-grandpa, my dad, and my youngest brother all died from alcohol overuse. It's heartbreaking to watch it just get passed down. An addiction to work is also present in the lineage and in me. So I wondered, before I went to Ireland, if all of this somehow, this generational trauma is what it is, was around the famine, around starvation and survival, and maybe the need to medicate, self-medicate some of that, the need to relieve the stress of it all. So I went to the town of Monaghan, where this line of men originates, and I started in the library and met with the genealogist, and we had fun looking at the parish records, came up with nothing. So I decided to move beyond my left brain and the data and just sink back down into my heart and my soul. And I went out and walked around a lake. And then I sat down on a bench, and I looked down, and there was an inscribed square of cement that said this: remembering all the people of Monaghan who died, suffered, or emigrated during the Great Hunger, 1845 to 1850. Great is our loss. Well, those were my people. Ancestry.com had confirmed that they emigrated probably in 1846 because my great-great-grandma was born in the U.S. in 1849, but her parents were married in 1845 in Ireland. Great is our loss, and great is our generational trauma. And so I was trying to sit on that bench, getting the feel. What was the feeling of that line? What was the feeling of that ancestral line? And it felt tangled, like just a complicated, tangled mess. And so I found some sticks and I tangled them all together, and I found a place just to release them into the water. And I released the sticks and they just dissipated, and I felt this feeling of striving and starvation and always, always, always working melt away into the water. And I got up off my hands and knees, and I looked up, and there was a sign that said, alcohol-free zone. I could not believe it. It's personal, and it's also collective, because these relatives of mine immigrated to escape the horrors of starvation. They likely traveled at the bottom of a boat for 10 weeks. I went to a museum that simulates the whole immigration process in the 1800s. By the 1900s, it only took 10 days. But in those days, it was 10 weeks underneath, only 20 minutes on the top of the boat. No wonder I'm seasick all the time, like generational trauma, literally. And no wonder I have this like unexplainable sort of pushing on me of compassion for those who are immigrating now. It's personal, and it's collective, and it's spiritual. It's the work of the heart and the soul. Ancestry.com and 23andMe only take it so far. When we go back and fetch it from our heart and our soul, whether we have the facts right or not, when we go and feel it, we fetch healing. I'm a German-American on my mom's side. My great-great-grandmother Henrietta came to Colorado in 1890 from Germany. She settled in Greeley, and she and her husband Herman owned the bakery on what is today Main Street. She played a very large role in raising my grandmother Eunice, who in turn played a role in raising me. And by the time I was born in 1863, there was no German spoken. What did I say, 18? Oh, God. I'm looking good. 1963, yes. Well, there's no German spoken, no German food cooked, no German music, no German art. Nope. From what I can see and recall, old Henrietta, she and her husband Herman left their memories at the border on the boat that brought them. Just after, about a year after I was born in 1964, my grandmother Eunice and my grandfather Don went to Germany on vacation and wandered into a little town just north of Frankfurt called Sachsenhausen. She and my grandpa went to the local Lutheran church and found the priest there and said, "Do you by chance know where the Henrietta Bock family might have lived?" Now, because they didn't speak German, because that had been stripped from their household and their culture, there was a lot of charades going on, apparently, and the priest just finally took them by the hands and brought them to Aunt Elsa. Aunt Elsa, who still lived in the family home, the Bock family home in Sachsenhausen. It was quite a reunion, apparently. A relationship was formed, and Aunt Elsa came to America for a visit. And almost 40 years later, that was several years ago, my mom and I decided to take my two kids to visit Aunt Elsa. I want to acknowledge my privilege in being able to fly. I don't believe we have to do this work by actually going to the places. It's powerful if you can, but I acknowledge that I could afford some airfare. Good news is when you get over there, the families host you and they treat you like, you know, relatives. So, Elsa, she arranged all these get-togethers. I mean, we had dinner and soccer games. The kids barely spoke the same language, but they had no problem communicating. We did castle tours, and we had over a week of interactions. And I began to recognize some resemblances. That nose, those eyes, that smile, those familiar patterns of behavior. So many bossy women. Lots of fun and creativity and good cooking, and I felt the power of the land where they lived, where my people had lived, the farm that had been in the family for generations, the smell of the cow manure and the fire in the fireplace. I was part of this family. Now, was I German-American? I was not really that ready to accept that title. And after a week of pleasantries, I finally asked the dreaded question that I promised myself I'd ask, the one that kept me from fully embracing these ancestors and my identity, the question that would give me insight into my own pain and the pain that I know I've caused. So I asked it, what was our role, our family role in the Holocaust? The grandparents in the room had a very hard time talking about it. They were young at the time. They talked about the uncle, their uncle, who was in the mayor, the next town over, was the mayor of the next town over, who stood up to the SS and barely escaped a concentration camp. They told other little stories, but that was the primary one to show me, to prove to me that we were not part of that extermination. But the honesty of my generation, my cousins, was really powerful because they concluded that our family had not done enough. It's likely that our people stood by and watched. We had work, they said. We have work to do now to restore relationship. And most of all, what is in our power is to never let it happen again. I was stunned by the honesty, and I felt some relief over their willingness to be that honest. And in that room, I could not deny that part of my identity which had been cut off during Henrietta Bock's travels to America. I am German-America. I'm a German-American. And so how will I never let it happen again? How will I learn from the past and stop any and all racism, any and all supremacy of any kind, anything and all things that jeopardize the well-being and the interdependent web of life? I am my grandmother's prayers, and I am my grandfather's dreamings. I am the breath of my ancestors, and I have the power to break ancestral patterns, whether it's workaholism, alcoholism, standing by and doing nothing. I have the power to celebrate the gifts and the blessings, the entrepreneurship, the perseverance, the risk-taking, the humor, the creativity of my ancestors. And so do you. In remembering our roots, we connect to them. And in the connecting, we become more realistic about the past. We learn from experience, and we avoid the dead ends and the pitfalls of history. It's personal, it's collective, it's spiritual. It's the work of the heart and the soul. When we go back and fetch it, we fetch healing. Sankofa.